you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Very good morning to you. I'm Larry Mantle. As you've been hearing, O.J. Simpson has died at the age of 76 about an hour ago. His family posted a statement on O.J.'s X account. On April 10th, our father, Orenthal James Simpson, succumbed to his battle with cancer. He was surrounded by his children and grandchildren during this time of transition. His family asked that you please respect their wishes for privacy and grace. It signed the Simpson family that on OJ's ex, formerly Twitter account. We're going to be talking about O.J. Simpson and the legacy that still, for me, nearly 30 years after his globally famous trial, is still just hard to process. You know, for those of my generation who grew up with O.J. Simpson, a star on the USC football field, a great running back for the Buffalo Bills of the NFL, and then in retirement, going on to an extraordinary career as a sports commentator, as a star of TV commercials for Hertz, where he was hurtling over people on the concourse of airports to try and reach his flight, not only that, acting in films, a comedic actor. To have someone of that kind of profile accused of the dual murders of his ex-wife and her friend was just stunning. And then, of course, the trial of the century with all of the implications surrounding race and policing in Los Angeles, O.J.'s image and people's differing views of him. It's all so operatic, so huge. It's still hard for me to get my head around O.J. Simpson's life and everything that swirled around him. To help us through that process, we're joined by a retired veteran AP special correspondent who covered some of the biggest trials ever in Los Angeles, the Manson family murder trial, the Menendez brothers trial, the Patty Hearst trial, Daniel Ellsberg, the Pentagon leaker, the John DeLorean trial, the 1992 Rodney King beating trial. She was there for all of them, including every day of the O.J. Simpson trial. Linda Deutsch joins us. Linda also had ongoing phone conversations with O.J. for years after the completion of the trial. Linda, it's good to have you with us this morning on Air Talk. Thank you so much. Just first of all, your feelings about this personally as someone who perhaps in more recent years had more contact with him than anyone outside his family.
Yeah, I had not talked to him in about a year. For a while, we were constantly in touch, and when he got out of prison after serving time in the Las Vegas case, I had dinner with him and his daughter, Arnell, in Vegas when I was there, and that was the last time we saw each other in person, but we would keep in touch, and the last time I talked to him, he was fine. He said he was playing golf every day. He was very happy that he was a grandfather now. His family kept in touch with him and came to visit him. And things were very quiet with him, which is why he liked it. He did start a podcast at one point in which he basically commented on football. That was one of his things that he did in retirement.
It's almost, you know, a footnote compared to the double homicide and how high profile and how terrible those crimes were that he was accused of and acquitted of.
Right.
Though found civilly liable. But he then in the aughts had, he was convicted of stealing merchandise in Las Vegas, and he served time for that.
Yeah, his own souvenirs and memorabilia. That was kind of unbelievable that was going to jail for. But he served it, and he served it with dignity, and he told me what it was like in prison, that he was, he found it very interesting to get to know all the other prisoners. He started a library for them, taught some people to read. He made the most of it while he was the best that he could while he was in there. After he got out, he just lived a very quiet life.
We're talking with Linda Deutsch, who for decades an Associated Press reporter, well known for her coverage of the highest profile trials in Los Angeles, including the O.J. Simpson double murder trial in Los Angeles, which of course made international news and was closely followed by so many people because of it being televised. You had already done very high profile trials, but they had, like Manson trial, had not been televised, of course, as wild as that trial was, and that was something else. But here you are with a trial that is being televised. People are taking off work to watch it. How did that change how you covered that trial, if it did?
Well, it didn't change how I covered the trial, so to speak, but it did change my life in many ways, because I had been a well-known AP reporter, print reporter, for many, many years. But I had never been a visible presence on television. And now I was on, as the pool reporter, I was on TV every day, several times a day, because I would come out of courtroom and go down to the lobby of the criminal courts building, and all the TV stations would be there to get my pool report. The one thing that we did have to do to cover it while I was doing the pool was that we had a second reporter on the case who would take notes on what I was reporting and call it in, because I didn't want to be scooped on my own story. But I was able to give the story to all the other media.
After the trial, O.J. wrote a book called If I Did It, and one of the chapters details how he would have gotten away with it. He maintained his innocence, yet he wrote this book. Why do you think what did he say to you about why he did it?
For money. That's the only thing I can figure that he got paid for it. I think he later regretted that he did it. And that was really the last time that I guess he was in the news, because he just, checked out after that and didn't do any interviews or anything. The last time that he talked to me for publication, he said that he was never going to talk about the case again, because he said, why would I talk about the worst thing that ever happened in my life and my family's life? And I interviewed him so many times, and we talked on the phone a lot. I went down to Florida when he was there to talk to him. And every time he told me that he absolutely had not done this crime. And he never changed his view on that from what I, knew of him. He always told me the same thing. I didn't do it. And he said he didn't know who did it. And, that was it. But he called me the friend of the acquitted, because I was the only one that would continually mention that he had been acquitted of the crime. He wasn't convicted, even though in the public mind he was guilty. So many people still do jokes about him on television. I hope that will stop now. And a lot of people just assumed that he was guilty.
We're talking with Linda Deutsch, who for many years covered the highest profile trials in Los Angeles, including the O.J. Simpson trial. You know, I was mentioning, Linda, for me, Simpson was such a he had an image that was just so pristine, and all the things that he had done, up until the time he's accused of these terrible crimes, and then allegations that he had been abusive to his ex-wife, and photos of her with bruises that came, all these other things. And then the image just flips almost overnight from, someone who has anger management problems and is abusive and is suspected of carrying out these heinous crimes. Can you sort of speak to that? Because I'm trying to think of someone whose image has taken that big a shift in that short a period of time.
Well, he was an American hero at the time, and even up after he retired from the NFL. He was an incredible football player. He was in the movies. He was in the Hertz commercials. He was, you know, he was a guy who had a real great public persona. And then suddenly he was a pariah. As I said, many people chose to believe that he did it. It was kind of an unsolved crime at the end, because the LAPD and the DA's office believed he had done it, but they never proved it. And having covered that first trial, which lasted a full year, I have to say that I would have acquitted him too, because they didn't prove the case. And I do remember that on a day when the jury was about to go out and deliberate, Marcia Clark, the prosecutor, came up to my office and she said to me, "Do you think we even have a chance of winning this?"
Wow.
And I said, "The way you have a chance is if you get a hung jury," and they didn't. And the verdict came so quickly that the jury obviously had seen and heard everything and didn't have an awful lot to discuss. I think they deliberated 3 hours.
I think, you know, I haven't seen polls on this, but my sense is that the majority of Americans, despite his acquittal, think that he likely carried out the dual murders. With all your conversations, with covering the trial, have you come to your own opinion? You said that you don't think the prosecution proved their case, but have you come to your determination about whether he committed the crime or not?
No, that was never my job. I mean, I didn't have to decide if he did it or not. I just had to report it. And personally, I just didn't make a decision. He was a very, you know, nice person to deal with. He was always very charming. I remember in the Las Vegas case, Dominic Dunn, the writer, came in to cover it, and he had covered the trial and did not have good feelings about O.J., and I introduced the two of them. And by the second or third day that Dominic was there, he came up to me, he said, "Linda, I have to apologize for all I said because I really like the guy." And at the end, he said to O.J., "I hope you beat this."
Wow.
So it was, you know, if you talked to him and if you got his take on what his life was like now, there was nothing to hold him responsible for. If people wanted him to go to jail, well, he did. He went for 6 years. And in that trial in Vegas, I vividly remember the audio of the detectives who were going through his own memorabilia, which he was accused of stealing. And one said to the other, "Well, they didn't get him in L.A., so we'll get him here."
Well, and of course, he was convicted in the civil trial that the Goldman family filed against
him. No, there's no conviction in the civil trial. It's a
judgment.
Liable.
Civil liability, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And do you know if he paid any of that money? Did he have the means to pay anything to the Goldmans?
No, I don't think so.
We're talking with Linda Deutsch, who for decades covered the biggest criminal trials in Los Angeles for the Associated Press. She covered all of the O.J. Simpson trial. Finally, Linda, before I let you go, what do you see as the social impact of that trial? We've had miniseries, documentaries, many books written about it. The principals involved have all told their stories. What are we nearly 30 years from the time of that trial? What do we take from it, in your view?
Well, it had significance in so many ways. I mean, it was the first major trial to be televised from gavel to gavel, as they say. I knew people who changed their whole lifestyle, their whole schedule, their work schedule, so they could watch it on TV. It was a huge rating success. And it changed a lot of people's perception of what the courts were like, because they got to watch a TV live broadcast of what was going on in the courtroom. And a lot lot of people didn't have time to go to court or watch what was going on downtown, and they had never been to a trial, and they didn't know how it worked. And so it was a civics lesson in many ways. It also had a racial component because the key witness, Mark Furman, it turned out, had made some really bad racial comments about O.J. And, when the verdict came in, the community really was split in a way. Many people believed that he should have been acquitted at that point. The black community was definitely behind him. The white community was kind of split. And as the years passed, people decided to decide that he was guilty. But he never was found guilty.
Jessica.
It's like that with a number of cases. The same thing happened with Robert Blake. When he died recently, people said to me, oh, was he in jail? Well, he was never convicted. So,
yeah.
No, he wasn't in jail.
But that's how people stored it in memory. Jessica in Pasadena emailed, I was one of those who took off work to watch the trial. I'll never forget when the verdict came in, where I was, and the feeling of sickness in my stomach that the jury got it wrong. Juries can get it wrong, but DNA doesn't lie. That's Jessica in Pasadena. Linda, your response to that?
DNA had not been hugely explored at that point. It was really the first of the DNA trials. And even the DNA was corrupted. The way that it was collected was terrible. One of the detectives took a vial of O.J.'s blood and carried it around in his pocket all day in a hot afternoon. The DNA was unreliable in the case, and all of the evidence was questionable. And then the revelations about Mark Furman were overwhelming because he had done audio tapes with a woman who was writing a book on him, and he talked about his feelings about black people, about O.J. and Nicole, about... I mean, he was really a racist, and that put a whole new turn on the case. O.J. was basically a celebrity who overcame racial differences. It was like he was the first non-racial celebrity.
Well, didn't he say to people... and I'm paraphrasing here, sort of, I'm not black, I'm O.J., it's sort of,
I don't know if he ever said that, but that was the perception. He was everybody's hero. You have to have seen him play football to know how extraordinary he was. And then when he got on TV, he had this charming personality, and people recognized him, and... I don't think there was a day he could walk down the street without being recognized and people wanting his autograph and really, looking at him as a hero. And then it all just flipped.
And I guess my point was that he was not a likely person to be a symbol of law enforcement abuses against African Americans because he... prior to this, really didn't put himself into a racial category, didn't see that as central to his identity. But of course, during the trial and the criminal justice system's treatment of African Americans comes front and center. And at that point, his identity as a black man is very much a part of what's happening in the courtroom and in the public consciousness of the trial. Linda, thank you so much for talking with us about it. We appreciate it. And
I know, Larry, and I appreciate that you really know the story.
Thank you so much. Linda Deutsch, I was there covering it from a great distance. She was there on scene. I was talking about it almost every day on Air Talk during the time of the trial. Gosh, it's hard to believe. That's almost 30 years ago. That's just incredible. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Linda Deutsch, retired Associated Press special correspondent who covered so many high-profile trials. Tony in West Hollywood say he may have been acquitted, but he was abusive as a spouse, and we had the evidence of that. Tony, I appreciate you weighing in. I'd love to hear from listeners with your thoughts about the death of O.J. Simpson. He died at the age of 76, died yesterday according to his family's announcement on X. We're at 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@laist.com. Please include your location and first name. Morning Edition's A. Martinez joins us next.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
O.J. Simpson, dead at the age of 76 of cancer, according to his family posting on X that he died yesterday, surrounded by his family. Francis in Riverside emailed, "I vividly recall being in the third grade and having our teacher wheel in the TV and stop everything so we could watch the verdict. I remember being too young and definitely thinking this was inappropriate to bring into a classroom with young kids." Bob in Studio City emailed, "OJ got off thanks to America's fascination with celebrity, plus the prosecution didn't make the case." Jessica, I shared that about her taking off work to watch the trial. And my son Desmond, up at Stanford Law, wrote, "Dad, I vividly remember watching the Naked Gun movies with you and Mom. I'm young enough that I never had the chance to watch those films without knowing about OJ's legal history. I found the films brilliantly funny, but I had to put it out of my mind that I was watching OJ. Otherwise, it would have been nearly impossible to enjoy the films without being distracted by thoughts of his trials, his incarceration, and his infamous book, If I Did It." That posting from my son, Desmond. Joining us now, host of NPR's Morning Edition, A. Martinez. A., I was talking about how I still, decades later, have kind of a hard time getting my head around the shift from O.J. Simpson, this tremendous athlete and public personality on television and doing sports commentary and acting in films, to being accused of this heinous crime. How do you make sense of that juxtaposition?
Yeah, it's difficult because, okay, so you remember me, my previous life, I was a host of Dodger Talk. I traveled with the Dodgers for 10 years, and I would see athletes have a public persona and then have a private persona, a persona that they would never reveal if anyone could see them, like interacting with their teammates or maybe not interacting in a very friendly way with fans. But then all of a sudden, when cameras were around, they would be a completely different person. So it became really, really clear. And I think this happens in entertainment, in sports, in almost every walk of life, where there is what we see and what someone likes to put out there as what they really are, and then who they are in private. And I think that became very obvious when we finally found out about O.J. Simpson and how he treated his wife, Nicole. We didn't know that before really the trial began. And all of a sudden we had a different picture of a guy who, as I heard you describe him, you know, very affable, friendly, just a fun guy in all those Naked Gun movies and the Hertz commercials, and then his other persona as one of the greatest football players that's ever lived. So I think shattered that perception for a lot of people, and it got people thinking about how, you know, there is a public persona and a private persona, and sometimes the two don't match.
We have listener comments, including Chris in Larchmont Village. My recollections go to the sheer incompetence of the L.A. County DA's office and the police, starting with the decision of Gil Garcetti, who was then the DA, to try the case downtown rather than in Santa Monica to get a representative jury. Marcia Clark's inability to prepare and pick her witnesses, as in the case of Mark Furman. Ditto Judge Ito's inability to control the case. I have to give credit to the entire defense team between their advocacy and the DNA discussion. The other thing I remember was the Ford Bronco going down the freeway and the media's coverage. This was not the ascertainment of guilt or innocence. It was a media circus. Chris, that's incredible. And we didn't even get to the low-speed chase on the freeway. I mean, A, that was, again, that made national news. And wasn't there an NBA, there was something that was on at the same time. Didn't they cut away or something for the chase? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, maybe it was the Knicks. It might have been the NBA Finals or a playoff game. It was the Knicks playing. I think it was the Rockets and the Knicks in the NBA Finals. And that it was on a Friday, I believe, because I remember I wanted to watch the game. I really wanted to watch it. It was a great game. I wanted to watch it. And then I couldn't watch the game. I couldn't focus on the game because of what was going on. And then obviously it was on every single channel, the chase. So it became what you only thought about and saw about for hours. But I couldn't leave the screen. I mean, you couldn't get up to go to the bathroom. You couldn't get up to drink water. I mean, every other part of being a human was gone because your eyes were glued to that screen and there was nothing you could do to move you away from it until you saw what was going to happen. And it took so long and it seemed to be agonizing how long it took because you know, you knew it was OJ in the truck or in the Bronco. And in a weird way, Larry, even though you knew what he was accused of, I didn't want to see him get hurt. You had all these cops behind him. I was worried, is he going to get into a shootout? Is he going to kill himself? I didn't want to see that happen. He's a hero, right? So you didn't want that to happen. But then he shows up to his home and his son comes out. And now you're wondering, okay, now how is his son going to try and coax him out of this situation? It was, I mean, every emotion possible was brewing. I can just thinking about it right now, the hair on my arms is standing up because I remember how conflicted I was based on the accusation and then based on who he was in my life as a sports fan.
Yeah, you nailed it. It's just, and it was so wild as I had then and I still all these years later. It's almost unbelievable. If someone wrote this, you'd just say this is preposterous. Real life. And then, of course, you just can't forget at the center of this is this terrible crime. These two people just viciously murdered. And sometimes in all the circus atmosphere around it, that did get lost, that there were two victims who were at the heart of this. So many high-stakes things going on. Let me share some more listener comments. Imelda and Hawthorne emailed, my parents' house was next to the 405. I'll never forget the freeway shutting down as OJ drove during an emotional crisis trying to escape. Jason in Inglewood writes, I hope the trial would bring light to the major flaws in the criminal justice system. Almost 30 years later, at least this man can rest in peace. Unfortunately, we still need major reforms. That's Jason in Inglewood. Stewart in Valley Glen emailed, I'll name no names, but a good friend of mine was on the jury in the civil case. He told me in no uncertain terms, the jury was unanimous on the first vote, which took minutes after they entered the deliberation room. I have no way of confirming Stewart's account, but that's what he said. Stewart is a frequent emailer to us on the program. These are just a few of our listener comments that are coming in. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing. And a final thought before I let you go. Just about the passing of O.J. Simpson and the complexity of how we consider him now.
Well, the one word I have for everything is wondering what really happened on that night that Ron Goldman and Nicole Simpson were killed, wondering what would have happened with the trial if Mark Furman had not met with that Hollywood screenwriter and admitted that he used the N-word. Wondering what would have happened if OJ didn't try on the gloves and we got the phrase, if the gloves don't fit, we must acquit. Wondering about all that and so much more. And now that OJ is gone, I think we'll be wondering pretty much for the rest of our lives.
Hey, thank you so much. Appreciate it. A. Martinez, host of NPR's Morning Edition, joining us to talk about this. Sean in Redondo Beach said, my friend was on the jury for that Las Vegas trial. And I asked her if she knew anything about his background. She said, no, she didn't. And she said she never considered the previous criminal trial at all. Sean, thank you so much. Again, we have no way of confirming it. It's something that our listeners share with us, and we always appreciate our listener input with us here on Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Again, in case you just tuned in, O.J. Simpson, announced by his family, died yesterday at the age of 76 as a result of cancer. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. We'll be back in just 90 seconds.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Boeing, of course, has been in the throes of controversy and condemnation of some of its manufacturing processes in the wake of the door plug blowout on an Alaska Airlines flight back in January. And the Wall Street Journal has done just some terrific reporting, looking at Boeing's practices. Of course, we've had so many major developments around the company. Just weeks ago, three senior Boeing executives, including its CEO, stepping down. There's a federal investigation surrounding the door plug blowout on the Alaska Airlines flight, where passengers have apparently been told that what happened to them being aboard that flight involves a criminal investigation. With us is Andrew Tangle, who's aviation reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it and the reporting that the Journal has been doing here. Let's just sort of step back and you know, give us the high altitude, pardon the pun, overview of what it appears in Boeing's systems have led to these problems.
With regard to the door plug blowout, there appears to be a total just breakdown in quality. One of the U.S. senators getting a briefing on the NTSB investigation said something to the effect of, when people get on an airplane, they expect the doors to stay on. And so it's clear at this point that something went wrong in the factory, but it's not clear why. And there are investigations underway to sort of suss that out. Is it something regarding the culture at Boeing? Was it a worry about, you know, production over safety and quality? It's really going to be interesting and to watch the investigations unfold, but also at Boeing and the rest of the industry really have to learn from this to prevent this from happening again, and we're just going to have to sort of wait and see what happens.
You reported on communications of Boeing employees who were working on the door plug, which hadn't previously been reported. What additional details did they give about the state of the factory where the door was being installed?
Yeah, we reviewed the sort of internal factory Slack messages for this particular problem on this particular aircraft. It's sort of like a ticket number when you have like an IT problem, you know, in an office. You know, a ticket gets generated, and you know, people working on it, you know, try to solve the problem. And you know, in this case, it shows us how over the course of 19 days, Boeing employees tried to address a problem that they found with a fuselage sent to them by their troubled and major supplier, Spirit Air Systems. They were trying to fix damaged rivets. Boeing people flagged it. They started the process to fix the rivets. And you see the frustration bubble up in these messages as the days went on, because the Spirit workers who are working on site at Boeing's Renton, Washington factory weren't addressing the problem. There's just a lot of back and forth about just fixing the rivets. And meanwhile, the fuselage is making its way through the factory, and it's still not getting complete. And so, you know, more than 2 weeks go by, and you see more and more attention getting to this as it becomes a bigger and bigger problem. Boeing employees are escalating the situation, getting higher and higher levels of management involved. You know, it just shows the disarray and difficulty that it can take to fix a quality problem that comes into the factory. And so ultimately what happened, you know, you see it sort of build up towards the end of this sort of mini saga within the broader tragedy here, or I should say near tragedy. Thankfully, nobody was killed in all this. You see it build up. The Boeing workers need to provide access to their damaged rivets for the Spirit employees. And so how do you provide access? You have to open or remove the door plug in question to get access to those rivets. And so you see the chat messages back and forth about performing this quote-unquote removal. And then you see that the door crew manager has communicated that the door is going to be opened. And to open the door, you got to take out four critical bolts that we now know, apparently, according to the National Transportation Safety Board, were not reinstalled.
Yeah.
Right. And so something broke down, and it appears that there wasn't documentation for a quote-unquote removal as part of this process. At least that's the hypothesis of Boeing. The NTSB has said we don't have this documentation. And, you know, one thing, you know, we pointed out, and I've, you know, we've been hearing as we report about this, is that manufacturing in aerospace is heavily regulated and heavily documented for all the reasons that you would imagine. It's a, you know, complicated product, and you know, people's lives, the safety of the aircraft is on the line. And so when you ever take apart or take apart off or alter something significant on an airplane in manufacturing, you've got to document it. Mm-hmm. And in this case, you have to write a removal. That's what it's called. And writing that removal and starting that process would trigger a separate process by which quality inspectors would check to make sure that that door was put back properly with the bolts back in place, and that the door was just as it should be, just as the FAA approved.
And that's what didn't happen here?
Apparently not. I mean, the investigations are not over, but, you know, Jennifer Homendy, the chair of the NTSB, was before the Senate complaining that they've asked for these documents and Boeing hasn't supplied them. And Boeing wound up saying, we don't think we have them.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's just hard, I think, for us in the general public to understand, because if you're doing things out of sequence as you're constructing the plane and you're not documenting that, and what you have to go back, that just seems, as you're describing, it's such a basic part of the manufacturing process. Not even, you don't have to be an expert to know that. And the fact that that documentation doesn't appear to be there, it's shocking. And does it appear that much of this really lays at the feet of the demand to supply all these jets and Boeing trying to keep up with that pace of demand, and that there were things falling through the cracks? Is that, I mean, no, it's probably an oversimplification, but does much of it come down to that?
I think that's a major question hanging over the various investigations. We don't know. I mean, we talked to somebody who worked on this particular aircraft in the story, and they said, yeah, there's pressure, just generally speaking, but yes and no, but, you know, they've got a job to do. But there's been a lot of attention at Boeing to, you know, make sure that pressure doesn't get in the way of safety and quality. And they have, you know, to varying degrees, at least tried, or at least talked about trying to, make sure that employees can raise their hands, slow down the process if there's a safety issue. So, we really don't know. And the fact that the documentation wasn't done and that process wasn't done is bewildering to people we've talked to, including somebody, we quoted in the article who did work related to all this. So, you know, why did this not get done? That's
the big question.
Andrew,
thank you so much for talking with us about the outstanding reporting the Wall Street Journal is doing on this, the writing that you've done, and all the many, many days, of course, devoted to this. Thank you very much for talking with us about it, and we'll probably be checking in with you again in the future as this investigation continues. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Aviation reporter for the Journal, Andrew Tangle, with us. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Back in a minute. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. A recent poll from Harris X looked into the movie-watching preferences of adults across the United States, and the findings quite interesting for what they telegraph about the future of movie theaters. Joining us is Gabriella Schulte, who is the Vice President of Marketing and Communications for Harris X Polling. Gabriella is also the head of data journalism and oversaw this poll. Gabriella, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your findings are that 34% of American adults prefer to watch movies in theaters. The bad news, I guess, for theater operators is 2/3 would rather wait to see them on streaming. Do we have previous polls to compare the results with to see if this represents a shift?
You know what? We did this poll right after the Oscars, and it was really kind of to gauge people's, attendance in theaters. Did they watch the Oscar movies in theaters or streaming? So this was kind of like a poll on its own. So we don't really have too much data, in the past, though we do kind of, we are noticing trends that streaming is sort of, as this poll suggests, streaming is king currently.
Well, and I wonder about the age of it, because it still seems like for tentpole movies, we have Dune 2 that was out recently, that people will go to theaters, particularly if there's IMAX screenings of large effects-driven kinds of films like Dune 2. And I wonder if that also represents an age break. Are younger people more apt to go to movie theaters than older people?
Right. And I think if you look at the numbers too, the reasons in which people do go to the theaters is the experience of watching movies on the big screen. So these sort of advantages of seeing, like you said, Dune 2 on IMAX, that's definitely a reason that are going to get people in the theater seats. And we do see an interesting age breakdown. 40% of voters, or I'm sorry, people who took the poll, 18 to 34, said they prefer to watch movies in the theater, and that's the highest age bracket. People 34 to 49 say that's 28% prefer to watch it in the theaters, and then it's about that range as people get older. I do want to say, though, that, like, I think there is a silver lining here for theaters. Mm-hmm. Still a good chunk, 34%, say they prefer to watch movies in a theater. And if you look at some of the different data, people do cite costs as a deterrence. Mm-hmm. People do say, you know, the comfort of viewing their movies in their home is a big kind of benefit. But we did ask a question about, for example, how long do you think movies should be? Most people say they should be about an hour and a half to 2 hours. So I think
I would join with that.
Right. Yeah. So I think if theaters sort of adapt to this new era of where, you know, streaming is really dominating, but if theaters could kind of, you know, shift some sort of strategy where, okay, maybe they're promoting a little bit shorter movies, maybe they're finding ways to cut costs on certain things, I think they can get attendance up. We are seeing, you know, global cinema attendance worldwide. There's a report in S&P Global in late February that found, you know, global attendance in the cinemas is rebounding. It's not at historic levels yet. But again, I don't think it's doom and gloom just yet for theaters.
I love some of the other findings here in this Harris X poll. 24% said they're just not interested in going to a theater to see a film. You had 22% who said it was restroom usage, that at home you can pause the movie, go to the bathroom, go to the kitchen and then come back, which I thought was interesting. And distractions from other audience members, 19% of people cited that. 15% said just the travel time to the theater, dealing with parking and the like, because, of course, a lot of movie theaters now are in larger complexes where parking's a little bit more of a production. So that was a number of the things that people cited. But also what drew people to theaters was the fact of it's only shown in theaters, 30% cited that. Advanced viewing technologies, the same number, 30%. So that argues, again, for these event films like Oppenheimer, correct, like Dune 2, that are going to pull people to those kinds of screens and audio systems.
Absolutely. It's definitely the special equipment that you can only really get right now in a theater that is driving these people who are, you know, again, 34% say that they do prefer going to movies in the theater. And I think another interesting finding that might be a little bit hopeful for movie lovers is that we asked if people, you know, are open to Academy Awards allowing AI-enabled movies in the future. And almost to a 2-to-1 margin, people are against it. So there's definitely a hunger for, you know, an authentic cinema experience. I think, you know, but like we said, sometimes the inconvenience of where a theater is, the convenience of being able to stream in your own home, sometimes, you know, that's not going to win over a certain population, but it seems like there is some data to suggest that if theaters adapt, we can get more people in seats. So,
yeah.
And, you know, we didn't do this for any theater company or anything like that. I'm just a theater lover myself. So
yeah, very good. We're talking about this poll from Harris X about what Americans say they want in the way of seeing movies, whether it's at home or seeing them in movie theaters. And you know, I'm struck by also the fact that, you know, a certain percentage, let me see, was around 26% said they want to see a movie with an audience. And I think that's particularly important for comedies. There's the infectiousness of hearing other people around you responding to a funny movie. I think of, you know, I saw The Holdovers, for example, one of the Oscar-nominated films, with an audience. And it was just, it was more fun, people responding to Paul Giamatti's character and the scenes in that film with an audience than it would have been had I watched it streaming at home. So I think there's a place particularly for comedies, particularly for films that benefit from a large screen with enhanced audio. All of that makes theaters particularly, you know, you can't duplicate that even with your large screen TV at home. It's not, you know, we can't have IMAX in our own our living rooms. Thank you so much. Right. We appreciate Gabriella, you being with us and talking about the survey. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. She oversaw this poll on what U.S. Movie lovers say that they want for seeing their films. Gabriella Schulte of Harris X, Vice President of Marketing and Communications, joining us on Air Talk. Even though it was just our first hour that we're closing, I want to take a moment to thank our terrific Air Talk production team who makes this program for you each and every day. We're led by senior producer Matt D'Angelo-Antonio. Our producers are Lindsay Wright, Lucy Kopp, Manny Valladares, and Michael Goldsmith. Our apprentice news clerks, Tamar Fagan and Jason Rodriguez. Our technical director is Evelyn Bocanegra. And they're all with us for the next hour of Air Talk. Momentarily, I'll tell you what we have coming up, but it's a big hour. I can guarantee that. Much to talk about. So good to have you with us on another beautiful Southern California day. Back in just a minute.
The stakes to save the Colorado River are high.
So if there's no water, there's no water for everybody.
California and six other states on the river must reach a compromise, but they're divided. The fate of the river may come down to a 28-year-old.
This is a historic thing coming.
The people and the real human drama behind the historic negotiations. Listen to Imperfect Paradise, the Gen Z water dealmaker, wherever you get podcasts.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us today. Coming up later this hour, TV Talk with our critics. They'll be focused on a variety of new series, some of which are getting a tremendous amount of attention. One of them, Fallout on Amazon Prime Video, is set in a post-apocalyptic Los Angeles and getting some very strong early notices. We'll find out what our television critics have to say about that later this hour. But the California legislature is looking at ways of improving Californians' happiness. Now, I know it's very tempting to insert a joke in there, but really, a special committee of the state assembly is taking this up, and we're going to be talking about it over the course of this half hour on Air Talk, because as we have seen from a variety of public opinion polls, our happiness level as Americans is in decline. Tremendous amount of rancor, discord, people having more difficulty getting along with each other, and a variety of things economically and social that are stressing us. Joining us to talk about a recent Public Policy Institute of California statewide survey, which looked at Californians' happiness, is Mark Baldessari. He's the director of statewide surveys for PPIC. Mark, you also spoke at that Select Committee on Happiness and Public Policy Outcomes. Share with us what Californians had to say about their level of happiness.
Thank you. And let me just summarize what I mentioned to the committee when I testified on March the 12th. In our a poll that we took in September 2023, we found that most Californians described themselves as pretty happy, 58%. 16% said that they're very happy, while 26% said that they're not too happy. Now, across most demographic groups and state regions, most people say that they're pretty happy, but fewer than one in five in these groups say that they're very happy. These results are consistent with national polling. National polls also find most people say that they're pretty happy. 25% say that they're very happy, so more people very happy in the national polls. 20% not too happy, so somewhat less, fewer. So in California, we also see a decline in happiness. When we first asked this question in 1998, we've asked it a few times since then. It's a question from the national polls. We're finding that fewer Californians saying that they're very happy, from 28% down to 16% today, and a growing number say that they're not too happy, from 13% now up to 26% today. Some demographic groups more than others expressing less happiness, and I can go through that if you'd like.
Well, I'm particularly interested in income because we know that California has particular financial stressors on people, giving the high cost of housing that exists here in California. And I wonder if that, in your view, is reflected at all demographically in the results when you look at people's income and access to housing.
Definitely. So that's exactly what I told the committee. 39% with household incomes under $40,000 described themselves as not too happy. 33% with less than high school education. 32% of renters. 30% of 18 to 34-year-olds. We also found in our polling that over time, that these groups, particularly lower income groups, and younger Californians, less satisfied with their jobs, their leisure activity, and their housing.
All right. We're talking with Mark Moldasari, who is statewide survey director for the Public Policy Institute of California, talking about the survey that PPIC conducted late last year, looking at the happiness level of Californians. California Assembly with a select committee on happiness, looking at what the state can do to try and improve the quality of life and people's levels of happiness. Mark, in the results of the PPIC survey that you conducted, are there any indicators, any advice you were able to share with the select committee on ways that lawmakers could enhance people's well-being?
Well, we said that based on our results, which weren't designed to look at solutions so much as general happiness today, that we recommend that they pay special attention to younger adults and lower income residents when they're making public policies, and particularly focus on issues related to jobs, leisure activity, and housing. There are a lot of different things that contribute to a person's happiness. And we know that we're also facing a time in which there's mental health issues, as well as physical health issues that contribute to happiness. But in particular, parks seem like an area where, related to leisure, how we go about relating to work, also important. But as you noted earlier, housing, a very important factor here in California with the cost of housing. And issues for renters about their future more in doubt than perhaps elsewhere in the country.
Yeah, I mean, you've got so many homeowners, particularly those who have low interest mortgages on their houses, who, you know, for them, this has been a very good investment. People are holding on to their homes longer, but people trying to get into the housing market, either looking for an affordable place to rent or looking to become a first-time home buyer with higher interest rates now, a very difficult time for many people saving a down payment to be able to get into a house, and a shortage of inventory available. So all of these are areas of stressors that, you know, Californians particularly are having to deal with, Mark.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yes. And so do Californians in our poll.
Yeah. Mark, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Just anything else to add before we let you go?
No, thank you for doing this program.
Appreciate it. Mark Baldessari, Statewide Survey Director, Public Policy Institute of California, who spoke before the Select Committee on Happiness and Public Policy Outcomes, which was convened by the Speaker Emeritus of the State Assembly, Anthony Rendon. He represents Southeast Los Angeles County. He created this committee to see what the legislature could do to try and enhance people's happiness here in California. And I'd love to hear from you. Do you have any suggestions for things that the legislature could prioritize, work that they could do to try and make happier Californians? We're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. Also joining us is Melixa Demir, who's assistant professor of psychology and happiness at Cal State Sacramento. Professor Demir, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, what are your thoughts about trends in happiness and what we're seeing? What do you think are the biggest drivers of happiness and of unhappiness?
Well, that's a great question. And there is no one key when we are trying to understand happiness. There's a recipe. And thanks to decades of research that has been published in the last 6 decades, we have a good understanding of things that contribute to individual happiness. And of course, one's personality makes a substantial contribution to how happy one is in any given time. But above and beyond this, we see that the leisure activities, what you do and with whom, as well as social relationships, the relationships to maintain, make substantial and meaningful contributions to one's happiness.
And those social connections, how are we seeing those today versus in previous years? We have the rise of social media, which enables people to be connected with others in a way they simply couldn't before. There are questions about what the implications are with that, with in-person socializing and the building of social networks of people who are truly close to us versus those who are just acquaintances. What are your thoughts about our social fabric and how connected we are in a meaningful way with others?
Oh, that's a great question. I think before we address that question, one general finding coming from my online of research could be shared. When we are looking at the association between friendship quality and friendship quantity and how they make a difference in happiness, we do see that it is the quality of friendships that you have, not necessarily the quantity. With this information shared, I believe the advance in social media made the building connections easier. My interpretation of the available literature is that it depends on the purpose that you use social media for. If you are using to establish connections, but most importantly, to maintain connections, then it's going to make a significant contribution to your overall well-being.
We're talking with Assistant Professor of Psychology and Happiness at Cal State Sacramento, Melixa Demir. Also with us is the aforementioned Speaker Emeritus of the State Assembly, Anthony Rendon, who has created the Select Committee on Happiness and Public Policy Outcomes. Assemblymember Rendon, thank you for being with us.
No problem, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much. So what are the potential areas where you think the state legislature could help people become happier?
Well, I think as we've heard from the professor and from Mark earlier, I mean, there are certain key areas that are appropriate for the legislature to be involved. But at the same time, insofar as this is about information gathering, I think it's also important for us to be cognizant of those things that government can't do, and that people, you know, whether it's the relationships that the professor talked about, the depth of those relationships, those are things that people have to kind of figure out on their own. They're things that we can do to enable the environment to help facilitate those things. But there's a role for government in some aspects of human life, human endeavors, and we know there's also a place where government need not be involved necessarily.
One of the things we're hearing from listeners right now, Mario Montebello said, I think we'd be happier if some of our issues were successfully addressed, like homelessness. Omri in Beverly Hills, similar comment. I think we need to focus on the unhoused community before focusing on happiness. And David in La Crescenta said, I love everything about California, but I think that socialized health care would make a lot of people happier given the cost of health care, even with insurance. Assemblymember Rendon, how much of this is about the legislature and the governor successfully making inroads in some of these longstanding problems the state faces, and how much of it is in finding ways in maybe more sort of day-to-day things, giving people support for enriching their lives?
Well, I think it's both, and I think that's the key question when we talk about happiness in general. We all know people who have financial means, who have homes, who have families, who have a lot of the material things in life that people strive for, who aren't happy. We know people like that all the time. To assume that we would be a happier society if everybody were clothed, to assume we would be a happy society if everyone were clothed, if everyone were fed, if there were no homeless people on the street, I think it's incorrect. When we talk about human relationships, when we talk about experiences, when we talk about learning new things, that's completely different. And that is ultimately what makes us happier.
We're talking with Assemblymember Anthony Rendon, Speaker Emeritus of the State Assembly. His district includes a large swath of Southeast Los Angeles County. He created the Select Committee on Happiness and Public Policy Outcomes. Assemblymember, what are the next steps for this committee?
We're going to do our second hearing. We had our first hearing a few weeks ago. We're going to do our second hearing in a few weeks. Our first hearing involved Rocco Ballack, the filmmaker who did the film Happy. We had a whole host of speakers, including the Consul General from the Kingdom of Bhutan. Bhutan has long had they've long measured their gross national happiness. The next hearing that we're going to do, which will take place in a couple of weeks, is going to be more focused on sort of the generational aspects. What are children and young people looking at today? Or, what makes them happy? What obstacles do they face to their happiness? Older people, we know social isolation is a huge problem with our senior population. The government the municipal government of London is spending a lot of money to ensure that to battle social isolation among elderly folks in London. So those are the types of things we're going to look at. We're going to look at it from a generational standpoint in our next hearing.
The mayor of Fremont in the Bay Area spoke, dubbed the happiest city in America by Wallet Hub. Is it about having a Tesla factory in your city? What's the key there?
having jobs is good. Yeah. Having good jobs is important as well. But she also talked about parks, and she talked about social connections. She talked about the social connections. She talked about the extent to which the city tries to facilitate not only social connections through parks and community activities the way a lot of cities do, but the way that they try to do it across generations too, with matching up younger people with older people and those types of things. And we know that's very, very important as well.
Assemblymember Rendon, thank you very much for being with us and talking about the Select Committee on Happiness that you created. We appreciate it.
No problem, Larry.
Speaker Emeritus, the California Assembly, Anthony Rendon, joining us on Air Talk. We're talking about happiness and what role, if any, the state legislature could play, the state of California's government generally, in improving our happiness. Dean Altadena says safety and security in housing is a key to happiness. And Jerry in Sherman Oaks says generosity of spirit makes people happier. The government should encourage people to volunteer, stepping out of yourself and not working on your personal needs can make a huge difference in happiness. Well, I have to say, Jerry, I don't know whether it's that happier people tend to volunteer and give more of themselves, or people that volunteer and give more tend to be happier, but I certainly see the association just as you do. And I have to think getting outside of oneself and feeling of value to others is is a huge role in feeling your connection, your value in the world, and a sense of fulfillment and happiness. Terrific suggestion. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. We'll continue on this topic when we're back in a minute. Happiness, our focus on Air Talk, and I'd love to hear your ideas if you think there's a role for state government in improving our sense of satisfaction and happiness, fulfillment in the world. Join us at 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. You can also comment on our AirTalk page at las.com/airtalk. I also want to mention to you, you can sign up for the brand new newsletter that we're putting out starting this week. It's Air Talk Weekly, and you'll be able to sign up, subscribe to it. It'll be in your inbox every week via email, and it's a chance for me to connect with you very directly and share with you what's going on with Air Talk outside of what you hear on the air every day, to point you to some of my favorite segments, to also share what's happening behind the scenes and special events that I'm taking part in, whether it's speaking engagements or programs I'm doing outside of Air Talk or Air Talk on the road. So please sign up for the free AirTalk Weekly newsletter by going to las.com/airtalk. You'll see the sign up right there. I'd love to have you on our list so that I can fill you in on all that's taking place with AirTalk on a weekly basis. We continue our conversation on happiness with Assistant Professor of Psychology and Happiness at Cal State Sacramento, Maliksha Demir, joining us to talk about his expertise on this particular topic. Let me share some more listener comments as well, because there have been some terrific perspectives that have been raised. Scott and Azusa emailed, maybe if the state legislature used taxpayer money to better ensure all inhabitants of the state have sufficient food, clothing, and shelter rather than nebulous subjective fluff, happiness might increase. What a concept. We've got plenty of skeptics of the very idea that the legislature, by taking this up, could improve our qualities of life. Professor, what do you think? Is there value in the assembly taking this up?
Yes, absolutely. I testified in that hearing, and it was a fantastic experience. And as a scholar doing research on happiness and social relationships, it made me extremely happy that our state is taking this very seriously. And I've been listening to the comments of your audience, fantastic comments. But one thing that I like to highlight, that happiness is a necessity in our lives. It's not a luxury. And then we have, thanks to research, showing that there are a significant number of benefits of being happy. For instance, the comment that your audience made about people being more helpful. Happy people are actually more helpful and altruistic. They care more about their environment, and they are more likely to take action for their environment. So there are strong benefits of being happy. And I think we should keep this in mind as we try to understand how important this initiative is.
Professor, one of the things I keep thinking about when it comes to satisfaction in work, I've seen a number of surveys over the years which indicate the more control people feel they have in their job, typically the higher the rate of satisfaction is in the work. When we feel like we don't have much control, we're controlled by others, that leads to anxiety and to a lack of satisfaction. If you agree with that, what are the ways that you think that we can have a greater sense of control in our own lives?
In our own lives? Oh, that's a great question. I think one can start by answering the following question. Are you interested in becoming a happy person and becoming happier? If so, we do have well-established happiness-promoting strategies one can utilize in their lives, ranging from engaging in random acts of kindness, to practicing gratitude, to savoring, to practicing your signature strengths. The challenge for the person is to figure out what really works for them from this long list of happiness-promoting activities and start adjusting the frequency, finding the right dose for themselves, and practice them in their lives as much as possible, make it as a habit. And with these strategies, I think it's possible to feel that one is not only in control of their own emotional experiences, but they will also benefit from these various strategies that they will find fitting themselves.
And I think, you know, back to Jerry, our listener's comment about volunteering, one of the things that that does is it gives you a sense of contributing to the world, that in even a small way, and sometimes it's a very big way, you're changing people's lives. You're improving people's lives by what you're doing. And I think in this time when, you know, so many of us feel comparatively impotent, we don't feel like we have a big impact on the world, and it can be quite jarring and concerning, that if that is a way of feeling like, yeah, I can make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's research showing that it doesn't matter, for instance, you know, how much you donate. The amount doesn't matter. As long as you're interested in helping out someone else, even, you know, little gestures, little contributions are likely to make a big difference. And then we are, you know, social beings after all. And when we make a difference in someone else's life, and then when we observe the reactions coming from the recipients of these kind acts, if I may, it's going to make a significant and substantial contribution to our emotional well-being.
Again, we'd love to hear from listeners your input. What, if anything, do you think the state legislature could do through these hearings that this Select Committee on Happiness is undertaking to improve our level of happiness in California? We're talking with Sacramento State Professor Miliksha Demir, who's Assistant Professor of Psychology and Happiness, a specialty in that area of study. Chris in Granada Hills says, I'd be happier if Los Angeles was less crowded. Well, we have seen some decline in population, as for many people, they're not able to afford to live here. So that seems to be happening at this point, although who knows long-term what the population trend will show. Edith in Long Beach says, I think the state legislature could support groups like Surf Rider Foundation and Heal the Bay. Cleaning up the beaches is great exercise. We're happier when it's cleaner. 866-893-5722. Shirley in Menifee says, one really easy and cost-effective thing is to treat others with kindness. That's a very inexpensive option. Shirley, so true. 866-893-5722. And Jules in Claremont says, I think Northern California is better than Southern California because they have better transportation. I think not being able to walk everywhere impacts our happiness. Well, Jules, it's funny because if you go back to a less crowded Southern California, when cars made transportation much easier because freeways weren't as heavily impacted as they are now, I think you probably find quite a high level of satisfaction and people loving the automobile. What, you know, leads to stress and unhappiness now is sitting in traffic for hours on end. And you're certainly right that bolstered public transit could be a way of people feeling a kind of freedom that they don't now when we're so reliant on the automobile. 866-893-5722. Actually, we're gonna take a break. I want to thank Professor Miliksha Demir for joining us and talking about happiness. Professor, can we check back in with you around the next time that the Assembly Select Committee meets?
Of course, yes, absolutely. Definitely.
We look forward to it and exploring more of this research on happiness. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. We'll be back in just 1 minute.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiots and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. We're going to take you to live coverage of a news conference downtown Los Angeles at the old federal courthouse.
Baseball player Shohei Ohtani. The federal complaint filed just a few minutes ago charges Mitsuhara with bank fraud for allegedly stealing more than $16 million from Mr. Ohtani. According to the complaint, Mr. Mitsuhara stole this money largely to finance his voracious appetite for illegal sports betting. Our investigation revealed that Mitsuhara, a Japanese language interpreter, began working as a translator for Mr. Ohtani when he first came to the United States to begin playing professional baseball. Mr. Mitsuhara had first met Mr. Ohtani in 2013, so the two knew each other. Mr. Ohtani did not speak or understand English, while Mr. Mitsuhara knew English and was familiar with the United States. As such, Mr. Mitsuhara not only translated for Mr. Ohtani, but also acted as his de facto manager.
You're listening to a live news conference or just having a microphone issue that they're trying to iron out. This about the criminal investigation into Shohei Ohtani's former translator who was fired by the Dodgers after allegations that he had stolen money from Ohtani.
Our investigation has revealed that Mr. Mitsuhara, a Japanese language interpreter, began working as a translator for Mr. Ohtani when Mr. Ohtani first came to the United States to begin playing professional baseball. Mr. Mitsuhara had first met Mr. Ohtani in 2013, so the two men knew each other. Mr. Ohtani did not speak or understand English, while Mr. Mitsuhara knew English and was familiar with the United States. As a result, Mr. Mitsuhara acted as Mr. Ohtani's de facto manager. In 2018, shortly after Mr. Ohtani arrived from Japan, Mr. Mitsuhara helped Mr. Ohtani set up a bank account. That was a bank account that was used to deposit Mr. Ohtani's salary payments from professional baseball. Mr. Mitsuhara had access to that bank account, and he refused to give access to Mr. Ohtani's other professional advisors, including his agent, his accountant, and his financial advisor. And he told them that Mr. Ohtani wanted to keep that account private. In 2021, Mr. Mitsuhara began placing sports bets with a group of bookmakers who were linked to an illegal gambling operation. Over time, Mr. Mitsuhara's bets became more and more frequent. And over time, Mr. Mitsuhara's bets became larger and larger in amounts. Messages between Mr. Mitsuhara and the bookmaker show that he lost considerable money on those bets, but he continued to make the wagers, thousands of wagers over time. The bets do not appear to have been made on the sport of baseball. At the same time he started placing the bets with bookmakers, Mr. Mitsuhara began using Mr. Ohtani's account to make payments for the bank account. Mr. Mitsuhara had helped set up the account, so he was familiar with it, and he used that familiarity to access the account. The evidence we've gathered over the past few weeks has demonstrated that in total, Mr. Mitsuhara stole over $16 million from Mr. Ohtani's account in order to pay for these illegal sports bets. Phone and bank records show that Mr. Mitsuhara appears to have accessed Mr. Ohtani's bank account online. What is more, Mr. Mitsuhara lied to the bank to access the account. For instance, we've obtained recordings of telephone calls in which Mitsuhara spoke with bank employees, lied to them about being Mr. Ohtani, gave personal biographical information for Mr. Ohtani in order to impersonate him, and thereby convinced the bank to approve large wire transfers of large amounts of money to the bookmakers. I want to emphasize this point. Mr. Ohtani is considered a victim in this case. There is no evidence to indicate that Mr. Ohtani authorized the over $16 million of transfers from his account to the bookmakers. Mr. Tania stated that he did not authorize these transfers, that he did not grant Mitsuhara access to his account. But on top of that, we reviewed both Mitsuhara's and Mr. Otani's phones and their communications over time, over several years, thousands of communications reviewed by a Japanese linguist. And that review has demonstrated no discussion of betting, wagers, or authorization for transfers to bookmakers. Furthermore, there would have been no reason for Mr. Mitsuhara to impersonate Mr. Otani in calls with the bank if these transfers had been authorized. Also, when Mr. Mitsuhara would occasionally win on his sports bets, the winnings were not deposited in Mr. Otani's bank account, but rather in Mr. Mitsuhara's personal bank account. Finally, in a text message with one of the bookmakers, which is detailed in the complaint, which is available to you, Mr. Mitsuhara admitted to the bookmaker to stealing from Mr. Otani. Let me summarize. Our investigation has revealed that due to the position of trust he occupied with Mr. Otani, Mr. Mitsuhara had unique access to Mr. Otani's finances. Mr. Mitsuhara used and abused that position of trust in order to take advantage of Mr. Otani. Mr. Mitsuhara used and abused that position of trust in order to plunder Mr. Otani's bank account to the tune of over $16 million. And Mr. Mitsuhara did all this to feed his insatiable appetite for illegal sports betting. In this way, we allege in the complaint, Mr. Mitsuhara committed fraud on a massive scale. And let me note, what we filed today here is a complaint. Mr. Mitsuhara is presumed to be innocent, but you can see all the allegations that we've made in the complaint that's been filed. Finally, let me offer some thanks in this case. I want to thank the amazing investigative team in this case for the work that they did. Investigators with IRS Criminal Investigation, investigators with Homeland Security Investigations, and with our office, United States Attorney's Office for the Central District of California, worked tirelessly, worked quickly, and worked thoroughly to bring this charge against Mr. Mitsuhara. I want to thank in particular the assistant United States attorneys in my office who worked on this case. That would be AUSA's Jeff Mitchell, AUSA Rachel Agress, and AUSA Dan Boyle. Let me now, before we take any Q&A, introduce to the podium IRS Special Agent in Charge Tyler Hatcher.
You're listening to United States Attorney Martin Estrada of the Central District of California Live News Conference, downtown Los Angeles.
Good morning. Thanks, Martine. As you've heard, my name is Tyler Hatcher. I'm the Special Agent in Charge for IRS Criminal Investigation here in the Los Angeles Field Office. We often get asked, why is IRS involved in these kind of cases? And IRS Criminal Investigation Special Agents are the best in the world at following the money. And I want to give my comments to shed some light on how quickly the federal government, and in particular U.S. Attorney's Office, my office, and HSI, marshaled our resources to get a resolution to a victim, and in this case, Mr. Otani. The criminal complaint that was filed today definitively shows that that money, the $16 million that's in question, was in fact stolen. And we want to continue IRS Criminal Investigation's efforts in protecting sports at the highest levels. We have a long history of getting involved in cases dealing with sports at the highest levels, and this is just another great example of the federal government working together for a quick resolution. I'll turn that over to Eddie Wang.
Thanks, Tyler. Good morning, everyone. My name is Eddie Wang, and I'm the Special Agent in Charge for Homeland Security Investigations here in Los Angeles. HSI is the principal investigative arm of the Department of Homeland Security, and one of our top priorities is targeting illicit financial activities. As you just heard earlier today, a federal criminal complaint was filed alleging that Mr. Ippei Mitsuhara illegally transferred billions of dollars from Mr. Otani's bank account, for which he was not authorized to do so. These charges stem from the outstanding work of our special agents assigned to the HSI-led El Camino Real Financial Crimes Task Force, who worked collaboratively with our steadfast partners at the IRS Criminal Investigation and the U.S. Attorney's Office. In particular, I'd like to take a quick second to recognize the outstanding work done by the prosecutors on this case, Assistant U.S. Attorneys Jeff Mitchell, Dan Boyle, and Rachel Agres. Thank you for your work on this matter. Look, there is much work to be done regarding financial crime in the greater Los Angeles metropolitan area, but the El Camino Real Financial Crimes Task Force is up to the challenge and will continue to diligently target financial crimes like this. Thank you.
I'm going to try to coordinate Q&A, so...
You're listening to a live news conference from the U.S. Attorney's Office downtown Los Angeles on the felony charges filed against Shohei Ohtani's former interpreter.
There was an ongoing federal criminal investigation into illegal gambling businesses operating not just in our district but throughout the country, and that investigation ultimately revealed this bank fraud. We understood there was a significant amount of public interest in this case. There were a lot of question marks out there in terms of what had occurred. We wanted to get to those questions. I want to emphasize, though, that while we were able to work on this case rapidly, it was a very thorough investigation. You will see in the complaint review of thousands of communications, review of bank records, review of phone records, interviews that were done with several individuals related to this. So a very thorough investigation was done.
If I could ask a quick follow-up, you said earlier that you don't believe that the bets were made on baseball. How certain are you of that at this moment?
Based on the review that we have done, and it is, as I mentioned, a very thorough review, we do not believe any bets were made on baseball games. Yes?
Given all the evidence that you just laid out, what kind of penalty or punishment do you think Mr. Mizuhara could be facing? And does Mr. Ohtani have any chance of ever recouping any of that money that's been lost, stolen?
Mr. Mizuhara faces a charge of bank fraud. Bank fraud carries a statutory maximum penalty of 30 years imprisonment. But the ultimate sentence that he would receive, if convicted, would be based on a determination by the judge. The judge considers all the factors, all the background to come up with the appropriate sentence. That is for the court to decide. We will provide all the facts to make sure the court is fully informed in making that decision.
Can you talk about the degree to which Mr. Ohtani cooperated with the investigation involved?
Mr. Ohtani, as I mentioned, has been established as a victim in this case. I want to be clear that Mr. Ohtani has cooperated fully and completely in this investigation. He's not only spoken to investigators, he's provided access to his digital devices, to his personal information, to ensure that justice was done in this case.
And to what degree did EPE cooperate?
Excuse me, I didn't hear your question.
To what degree did EPE cooperate in the investigation,
Mr. Mizuhara? Mr. Mizuhara is charged in this case. He's presumed innocent, and I'll leave it at that. So this is the filing of a criminal complaint. Those are allegations that have been made. A criminal charge is filed. Mr. Mizuhara will now have to appear on that criminal complaint. That appearance should happen sometime in the next few days. Following that, we will prosecute the case wherever it goes. Whether Mr. Mizuhara admits his guilt or whether he decides to contest his guilt, we will follow it where the law appropriately leads us. He will be appearing in federal district court in our district.
We'll get you the details on that. Any more? Go right here.
Will Mr. Ohtani continue to be asked to take part in the investigation?
Mr. Ohtani has cooperated, as I said, completely and fully in this investigation. We expect him to continue to cooperate fully in this investigation. We don't have specifics in terms of requests that we would have right now, but certainly over time, We expect that cooperation to continue.
We're listening to a news conference in downtown Los Angeles at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Central District of California. It's the old federal courthouse. And as we just heard from U.S. Attorney for the Central District, Martin Estrada, the former Japanese language translator for Dodger star Shohei Ohtani has been charged via federal criminal complaint with unlawfully transferring more than $16 million. That's much higher than the amount that was earlier discussed as allegedly being taken from Ohtani's accounts. More than $16 million allegedly from Shohei Ohtani's bank account without Ohtani's knowledge or permission. The U.S. Attorney's Office is alleging that Ipe Mizuhara, the former translator for Ohtani, used that money that he allegedly illegally transferred to pay off substantial gambling debts that he allegedly incurred with an illegal bookmaking operation. Mizuhara is listed as a Newport Beach resident. The felony charges are bank fraud, and that includes, as we just heard from the U.S. attorney, a maximum potential sentence of 30 years in federal prison. Mizuhara is expected to appear in U.S. District Court in downtown Los Angeles in the coming days for an initial appearance on this complaint and the charges that are being filed. What's alleged here by the U.S. Attorney's Office is that between November 2021 and January of this year, Mizuhara wired more than $16 million in unauthorized transfers from a checking account belonging to Shohei Ohtani, and that money was used to pay off illegal gambling debts that were incurred allegedly by Mr. Mizuhara, and that this was done without any knowledge whatsoever by Shohei Ohtani. What the U.S. attorney further alleged is that Mizuhara, in carrying out the alleged fraud, actually portrayed himself in phone calls to the bank as Shohei Ohtani himself in an effort to complete those transfers. So that is further alleged. The amount of money that was talked about earlier was $4.5 million. Now we have over $16 million that is alleged to have been taken from Shohei Ohtani's accounts without his knowledge by his former translator. We'll have continuing coverage throughout the day here on LAist 89.3. We're going to take a brief break. We'll come back and hopefully get a couple of television shows in on our TV Talk segment of Air Talk. We'll be back in a minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Due to that live news conference from the U.S. Attorney's Office, we have an abbreviated TV talk with critics Melanie McFarland of Salon and Whitney Friedlander joining us to talk about their thoughts. We'll talk about a couple of big shows in the time. We've got Fallout, set in post-apocalyptic Los Angeles, adapted from a popular video game franchise, starring Ella Purnell, Aaron Moten, and Walton Goggins. Whitney, what do you think of what you've seen of Fallout?
Ipe Mizuhara.
Whitney? Well, I think we have something in the background there. I think we're just getting that cleaned up. Whitney, are you there? Okay. Whitney, are you there? Okay. Let me go.
Larry, can you hear me now?
Yeah, now we can. Go ahead, Whitney. Thank you.
Okay. I don't know what happened there. That's weird.
That's all right.
So in regards to Fallout, so it is very sardonic in its tone, which is not usually something you think of when you think of post-apocalyptic dramas.
No.
It stars Walton Goggins, Ella Purnell, and then it kind of has three different storylines going on. There's Ella Purnell's storyline, which is kind of set after the fallout and after we find out for the survivors of the fallout, let's say, so many years in the making. And it's set in a very, like, I don't know if you remember the Brendan Fraser movie Blast from the Past, like
yeah,
that kind
sure,
of situation
yeah.
where it's a, you know, a little more tongue in cheek, like they listen to, you know, like oldies music. They don't like, they're very into like this 1950s way of life. They don't really get the outside world. Walton Goggins' character was part of the outside world, but then comes back in a different form after the fallout. And then there's a character played by Aaron Motzen's character, who is much more of like, more in this, at least as far as this case goes, traditional sense of what you expect from post-apocalyptic show. He's a soldier and he's got to defend what's left of his country or his mm-hmm. world. And so you've got these three different timelines going on. And if you look at what Fallout is competing against, as far as like on the Prime Video platform, which has fantasy shows like Lord of the Rings and Wheel of Time, and then much more like serious, maybe even more conservative shows like The Terminal List and Reacher, this is more like The Boys and Gen V, which are both have their commentary about corporatization and like they're superhero shows, not for superhero fans. And this is kind of like that too. It is, of course, ironic that, you know, it's on Prime Video, which people have pointed out similar things about how The Boys and, you know, a sit on corporate. Does it talk?
Yeah, Wendy, I'm sorry to interrupt. We're really tight on time, but just sure. Bottom line, what'd you think?
I think it's fun. Which again, like it's probably a fun, easy watch.
All right. Fallout, we're talking about on Amazon Prime Video. Also, The Sympathizer on HBO and streaming on Max. What do you think, Melanie, about this series, which Robert Downey Jr. plays several supporting characters?
Well, since we're short on time, I'll just put it with the topmost idea. It is one of the most interesting, multifaceted, absurdist series that HBO has put on in quite some time. And so briefly what it's about, it's an adaptation of Viet Thanh Nguyen's 2016 Pulitzer Prize novel about a man that's known as the Captain, and he's played by Hua Shonde, who's an Australian actor of Vietnamese descent. And he is a double spy for the North Vietnamese, who also implants himself in the South Vietnamese secret police and was supposedly working with the CIA. After the fall of Saigon, he moves to America and continues to report back to the new regime there. But at the same time, he has this conflict between this idea that he's becoming American while he insists that he still wants to and still wants nothing more than to return home.
All right.
So in a real way, he's caught between these two dualities, and it's an amazing series.
The Sympathizer, streaming on Max on HBO Network. And my thanks to our critics, Whitney Friedlander and Melanie McFarland of Salon, for joining us and talking about these two very high-profile series that are debuting on their respective platforms. Stay tuned. NPR's Here and Now is coming up next. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock for Film Week, right after Austin Cross, who's hosting Air Talk in the 9 o'clock hour tomorrow. Have a great day.